Hi everyone, and welcome back to the 38th video for the Old Testament Survey course. In this section, we'll complete the major prophets by examining the book of Daniel. And let's start with some background issues. The book of Daniel is not a typical prophetic book. In the order of the Hebrew Old Testament, Daniel is actually in the writings portion. In other words, it's not with prophets like Isaiah and Ezekiel. Part of Daniel is like the historical books in that it is a historical narrative. And other parts of Daniel are closest in character to the New Testament book of Revelation. Or it would be more accurate to say the Revelation is like Daniel. The technical name for this type of literature is apocalyptic. Now, you can see your textbook for a more detailed description of apocalyptic literature. The point I want to make for our discussion is that even though much of Daniel comes in fantastic visions and symbolic dreams, it is not fiction, but it is real history and real prophecy that tells about real life issues and events for the people it is written to. And also, I want to mention that part of the book of Daniel is written in the Aramaic language. Now, the date when Daniel was written is somewhat debated. It's obviously set during the Babylonian exile, but some say it was written much later, just before the time of Christ. Now, the reason they say this is that Daniel accurately predicts the world history in the intertestamental period, which we'll look at in just a minute. Therefore, they claim it is prophecy after the fact. In other words, they claim it is telling the history that the author knew because it had already happened before the author's time. And the author wrote it as if he were writing before the fact and predicting it, even though he was writing after the fact. To put it bluntly, this particular view suggests that the book of Daniel is a falsehood, claiming to be something that it is not. Now, the primary reason why these people hold a late date for Daniel is the belief that God cannot or does not predict the future. However, the testimony of the rest of the Bible is that God can and does do so. So I think it is much better to take the date of Daniel at face value that it was written during the time of the Babylonian captivity by an eyewitness and a participator in these events. Now, feel free to check your textbook for further discussion on the date of the book. And the issue of authorship ties in with this issue of date. The traditional view is that Daniel is the author, and he's an eyewitness and a prophet of God. And the other view that somebody wrote after the fact, and then they used Daniel's famous name in order to get a hearing for their book. But that falls flat because Daniel is only famous because of this book. Now, Daniel and his three friends were Israelites who were deported in the first wave of exiles to Babylon. And they rose to positions of authority in Babylon because of their character and because of their faithfulness to God. And Daniel lived through most, if not all, of the Babylonian captivity, and most of that in a position of influence. So now, let's look at the organization of the book of Daniel. The outline of the book matches fairly neatly with the modern chapter breaks. Roughly, every chapter is one story or one section of Daniel. The first major section consists of narrative stories about Daniel, his friends, and the leaders of the Babylonian Empire. These are stories of faithfulness to God in the midst of idolatry and in tremendous pressure to conform to idolatrous ways. The first chapter is the food test, where Daniel and his friends, they stay with a kosher diet instead of eating the pagan food of the Babylonian court. And they are protected, and they are blessed for their faithfulness by God. Chapter 2 tells of King Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And God gives Daniel the ability to interpret this dream. And through Daniel, God reveals the four empires of history leading up to the New Testament time. Then chapter 3 is the test of idolatry under threat of a fiery furnace. And the three friends, they refuse to bow down to the pagan idol, even at risk of being thrown into the furnace. And therefore, they are thrown into the furnace. But God shows himself both faithful and powerful to protect them for their loyalty. Then chapter 4 is the humbling of King Nebuchadnezzar. He thinks he is great. Now, with some justification in terms of his position of power, but with no justification whatsoever in terms of his pride against God. Therefore, when Nebuchadnezzar glories in his own greatness, God humbles him until he acknowledges God's greatness and that God is the one who raises up and who deposes kings. Then chapter 5 is the writing on the wall. A later king named Belshazzar, he's arrogant against God. And during a party, he mocks God and God's people, Israel. So God sends a hand to write a message on the wall during the middle of the party. And then Daniel accurately interprets the message as judgment against Belshazzar and the overthrow of the Babylonian Empire, which then happened. Then chapter 6 tells of Daniel and the lion's den. Some jealous peers of Daniel set up an accusation against Daniel because of his prayer to God. And Daniel refused to stop praying to God. And so he is thrown in the den of lions. And just like is typical in this book, God shows himself to be faithful and powerful, and he keeps the lions from hurting Daniel. Now, the punchline for all of these stories is that God demonstrates his faithfulness and his power. And all the leaders of the pagan empires, they recognize and they acknowledge God's greatness. The nations are realizing that he is Yahweh. And then the second major section of Daniel consists of a series of visions given by God to demonstrate his sovereign rule over history. Chapter 7 tells of Daniel's vision of four beasts which correspond to four empires. And this vision ends with one individual who is given authority over all nations by God. And then the vision is interpreted for Daniel and for the reader. Then chapter 8 is Daniel's vision of two beasts that also represent two kingdoms. And this vision is also interpreted. Then chapter 9 is Daniel's prayer of confession for Israel's sins and his petition for God's restoration of Israel back to the land. And he is answered by a vision which reveals the timing of God's future activities by using the figure of so-and-so number of weeks from Daniel's time. Then chapters 10 and 11 are visions of a great war that seems to be parallel accounts of a spiritual war in the heavens happening at the same time with a natural political war in history. And these call God's people to faithfulness and encouragement in the midst of it all. Then finally, chapter 12 tells of trouble, then victory, death, then life for God's people. Now, all of these visions in the latter part of the book, they give encouragement for the reader that God is sovereign over all history, and he will bring all history to his just conclusion. And therefore, God's people are to remain faithful to him and to hope. Now, let's look at the content of Daniel, starting with some key verses. First is chapter 2, verses 19 through 22 and 27 through 28, which say, "During the night, the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision. Then Daniel praised the God of heaven and said, 'Praise be to the name of God forever and ever, Wisdom and power are His. He changes times and seasons. He sets up kings and deposes them. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to the discerning. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what lies in darkness, and light dwells with Him. And Daniel replied, "No wise man, enchanter, magician, or diviner can explain to the king the mystery he is asked about. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries. He has shown King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in days to come." Now, this passage shows that God is both able and willing to reveal things to His people when He chooses to do so. And nothing except God is able to do this. And therefore, He rightly gets all glory for these revelations. He is powerful to direct history for His purposes. The next is chapter 3, verses 16 through 18, and verse 28. It says, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king, 'O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it, and He will rescue us from your hand, O king. But even if He does not, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you set up.'" Skipping down, "Then Nebuchadnezzar said, 'Praise be to the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent His angel and rescued His servants. They trusted in Him and defied the king's command and were willing to give up their lives rather than serve or worship any god except their own God.'" Now, this passage tells of the faithful stand that these friends took against idolatry. They trusted God to save them no matter what. They will not bow down to the king's idol. And they committed to remain faithful even if God did not save them from the furnace. And this served as a witness to God's greatness before a pagan empire. And of course, God did save them, and the emperor confessed God's greatness. So God's reputation is spread by His people's devoted faithfulness, even in difficult circumstances. Then is chapter 4, verses 34 and 35, which says, "At the end of that time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes towards heaven, and my sanity was restored. Then I praised the Most High. I honored and glorified Him who lives forever. His dominion is an eternal dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the peoples of the earth are regarded as nothing. He does as He pleases with the powers of heaven and the peoples of the earth. No one can hold back His hand or say to Him, 'What have you done?'" Now, this passage is King Nebuchadnezzar's confession that Yahweh is God and that Yahweh rules forever. After Nebuchadnezzar was humbled, he came to the realization that God is God, and he acknowledges that God is sovereign over all kingdoms, including Nebuchadnezzar's own kingdom. Now, think about how desperately all the world leaders today, they need to realize and acknowledge this truth. God rules over all of them as well. Now is chapter 6, verses 26 and 27. It says, "I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. For He is the living God, and He endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and He serves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions." Now, this passage is the punchline of the Daniel and the Lion's Den story. This is the king's response to Daniel's rescue from the mouth of the lions. He confesses God's greatness and the rightness of acknowledging and worshiping this God. Have you noticed? Throughout Daniel, powerful earthly kings, they are brought to the knowledge and they confess and they worship the God of Israel, bringing partial fulfillment to the promise to Abraham that all the nations on earth will be blessed through him. And then next is chapter 7, verses 13 and 14, which says, "In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshiped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed." Now, this passage is a vision of a person called one like a son of man, who's given dominion over all nations by God himself. And it said that his kingdom will begin during the last world empire, and it will last forever. At the end of a couple of these visions, when it goes through world empires, one after another, a couple times there is a explanation, a vision of a kingdom that is greater than any earthly kingdom that will not end. And in this passage, we see the leader is kind of cryptically called one like a son of man. Now, this passage is referenced a number of times in the New Testament. And I also want to point out that the way that Jesus referred to himself most often is son of man. Then finally, it's chapter 12, verses 2 and 3. It says, "Multitudes who sleep in the dust of the earth will awake, some to everlasting life, others to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise will shine like the brightness of the heavens, and those who lead many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever." Now, this passage tells of the resurrection and judgment at the end. And notice there are only two options, either everlasting life or everlasting shame. And it's a call to persevere in faithfulness in order to shine like stars forever. These then are some of the key ideas in Daniel. And now I want to look a little bit more closely at something I've already referenced a few times already. This is the correspondence of the symbolic items in the dreams and visions in the book of Daniel, that they do correspond to real entities in history. Now, in chapter 2, we see Nebuchadnezzar's dream. And in his dream, he sees a vision of a huge statue. The statue had a head made of gold. Its chest and arms were made of silver. Its belly and thighs were made of bronze. And its legs and feet were made of iron. See, each successive metal is less precious, but stronger. And then the last item, the statue's feet were made of iron mixed with clay, because of being a divided people. And then at the end of this vision, we're told that in that time, a kingdom that will not end will be set up. Then let's look at chapter 7. In a vision where Daniel sees a series of beasts coming out of the sea. The first beast is like a lion. The second beast is like a bear. The third beast is like a leopard. And the fourth beast is a terrifying beast with iron teeth that destroys everything before it. And then chapter 8 is similar to chapter 7, except it only highlights two beasts. The first beast is like a ram with two horns, but the two horns are unequal. And then the second beast is like a goat with one prominent horn. And the goat wipes out the ram, and one of the goat's horns is broken off and then replaced by four horns. Okay, what does all this mean? Well, all of these visions are basically the same, telling the future from Daniel's perspective. They describe four world empires that controlled the promised land and God's people between the testaments. The first in all of these series represents Babylon. We've already talked about Babylon because it's described in the Old Testament. They conquered Judah and took them into exile. But then next, Babylon was conquered by the second item, which is an alliance of Medes and Persians. And they were an uneven alliance because the Persians were much more influential over time. Thus, it's represented by two uneven horns. And Cyrus, king of Persia, allowed the exiles to return to Jerusalem. And he developed a great Persian empire that extended to the east, to the north, and to the west. And he actually invaded all the way to Europe until he was turned back by the Greeks. Then the third empire is the Greeks. They grew stronger and stronger after they defeated the Persians until they eventually invaded the Persian Empire under Alexander the Great. And Alexander crushed the Persians and conquered all their territory, including the Promised Land. And Alexander conquered much more than that. Alexander's empire included Egypt and all the way to modern-day India. But then Alexander, who's represented by the one great horn of the goat, he died at a relatively young age, and his empire was divided among his four generals, which are represented by the four horns. And then eventually, the Greeks were conquered by the fourth empire, the Romans. And the Romans took control of all their land, including the Promised Land. And then during this last kingdom, the Roman Empire, Daniel prophesied that an unending kingdom would start, which would crush the Roman Empire and would rule forever. What kingdom is that? What eternal kingdom started during the Roman Empire? Well, let me give you a hint. That kingdom started during the reign of Caesar Augustus, when Quirinius was governor of Syria. Now, if you didn't catch that reference, check Luke chapter 2, and that's where you'll see that reference. But we're getting ahead of ourselves again. That is a New Testament survey. All these questions, all these things will be answered, including the identity of the Son of Man. But you see, all of these empires, all of this world history is being used by God to prepare for the revelation of Jesus in the New Testament. And as it were, God calls his shots. He tells what's going to happen before it does. Now, let's look at the theological themes of Daniel. First is faithfulness under pressure. Daniel and his friends, they demonstrate standing faithful to God, even when there's tremendous pressure to give in, even at the risk of their lives. They stood very counterculturally against the prevailing attitude and actions of those around them, even though it had the potential to cost them dearly. They were willing to stand alone and take the consequences if necessary, because God is worth it, no matter what. And the option of unfaithfulness is just unthinkable. And of course, we need to take a lesson from Daniel and settle in our hearts that we will be faithful no matter what comes, because God will never disappoint. And then the second theme is God's total sovereignty over history. God controls rulers and nations. He exalts one and tears down another as he chooses. And no one and nothing can stand against God's plans, because God is all-wise and all-powerful. And kings of nations are nothing compared to God. And God is doing something with history. He is working out his gracious plans for his glory. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that everything that happens is good, but it means that everything that happens is still under God's control. Even when we don't yet see how history is working out, it is, because God knows what he is doing. And then the third theme is God's humbling of the proud. We see this in God showing himself greater than the prideful kings of Babylon. And in the end, they were shown their place, and they confessed that Yahweh is sovereign over all kingdoms. And then the final theme of Daniel is that God delivers his people. Daniel and his three friends, at different times, they took a stand of faithfulness for God. They risked the lion's den and the fiery furnace, but God delivered them in every case. And Daniel tells that God's people will be pressed by a series of hostile empires, but in the end, God will deliver and vindicate his people, because God is God, and nothing is stronger than he is. Okay, so now let's review. First, we'll review the organization of Daniel, which is a series of stories and a series of visions. And then let's review the theological themes. And they are faithfulness under pressure, the sovereignty of God over all history, the humbling of those who challenge God's sovereignty, and God's saving of those who remain faithful to him. And you can use the word fishes to help remember these themes, if it's helpful. And now, because Daniel is the last of the major prophets, let's review the one-word summaries of the major prophets. As usual, try to guess which word I will use to summarize each of the five books. The first major prophet is Isaiah. Now, Isaiah is a large book with a lot going on, so it's tough to choose just one word. But I've chosen the word salvation, because the overarching theme of Isaiah is God's rescue, his salvation of his people. And then the second book is Jeremiah. Again, there are a lot of words that I could have chosen, but because of the time in which Jeremiah ministered and the bulk of his message, I chose the word punishment. Jeremiah is primarily a message of judgment in the form of Babylonian captivity against Judah for their idolatry. Then the third book is Lamentations. I hope this one is fairly obvious, the reason why I chose the word sorrow. Because Lamentations is an expression of sorrow and repentance over the judgment which had been experienced. Then the fourth book is Ezekiel. This also was a tough choice because of the large amount of material in Ezekiel. And I chose the word restoration, because Ezekiel tends to highlight the hope of restoration and the hope of return after the Babylonian exile. And then finally is the book of Daniel. And I chose the word sovereignty, because the stories and visions of Daniel all emphasize that Yahweh is in complete control of all history. He is greater than any earthly king, and his kingdom is greater than any earthly empire. You see, the Babylonian, the Persian, the Greek, and the Roman empires, they all crumbled centuries ago. But God's kingdom continues to grow, and he reigns, or he will reign soon, in every nation, tribe, language, and people group. And he will reign forever and ever. That's good news. Now, that is the conclusion of all the major prophets. So that leaves only one more group of Old Testament books. So in the next section, we're going to give a brief introduction to the minor prophets. And then in subsequent sections, we'll look at each of the books of the minor prophets in turn. Thanks for watching.